Dixon. Appreciate the special music. That was very melodic. I hope if anybody was snoozing and sort of drifting off into la-la land, come back. But it's very melodic and very pleasant to listen to. Somehow I had this picture of a hammock, you know, in a nice shady spot, and maybe a little glass of iced tea or something, but maybe that'll just have to wait till a little bit later. Have you ever driven down the road and asked yourself just how many drivers are oblivious to the traffic around them or coming at them like you? Does it seem that there are more and more people who just drift across that yellow line just as you're approaching? And of course, sometimes as you pass, you see why. They're looking down and probably texting as they're driving. You know what happens next, right? You begin to talk to the other drivers. You say things like, keep your eyes on the road, or check your blind spot, or it's me here, you know, don't run into me, honk your horn. My wife gets concerned when she sees my hand hovering over the horn these days, but I assure her that I only use it when absolutely necessary, which is usually every time I'm driving somewhere. Does that sound familiar at all? What about a connected question? How often do you do or say or think those things while living your Christian life? We actually heard a sermonette today that served as a very good lead-in to the message I want to talk about today. And it's a good thing I didn't have Abraham and Sarah as one of the main points in the sermon, otherwise it would have been the world's shortest sermon. Not that that would be, you know, too terribly troubling, but obviously when we're talking about that experience back in the book of Genesis, we're looking at several people who had a series of blind spots that they just couldn't see where things might lead. But back to the physical analogy, those terrible other drivers on the road. Distracted driving, as it's usually phrased, is, I think, worse than it's ever been. And I think there's a number of studies, statistics that begin to bear that out some. Cell phone calls are bad enough, even when hands-free studies have shown that we're still distracted by them. Perhaps it's less difficult than others, but they still can be distracting. Because there have been, even before cell phones, you could be talking to another passenger. And even if you're keeping your eyes on the road, something about just being distracted, talking to someone else, can be troubling. My brother was very nearly killed in a related accident a number of years ago when he'd been skiing. He and his friend had pulled off to the far side of the road in an area that was designated chain removal area, where they were to remove the chains from having come down the mountain. And there was a car following them down the mountain. As it turned out, the driver was distracted, turned around to deal with squabbling children in the back seat, and ran so far off the road she hit him directly. It was at an angle, otherwise he probably would have died had he been crushed between the two cars. But as it was, he was pretty banged up with broken ribs and lacerations and cuts that took a while to heal. And that was years and years ago before there were cell phones. Factor in how many drivers are texting and driving, and it gets really scary. My wife read a book a few years ago she was telling me about. It was a story of a man who literally killed two rocket scientists. He was texting and driving. He first tried to dodge the charge, to beat the charge, but it came out in the court proceedings, and it was proven that the truck driver, whose vehicle struck the vehicle in which the two scientists were riding, was not the one at fault. This man was actually incarcerated for a time because it started a chain reaction, his car and then the truck trying to avoid. It led to an accident where two people died. When he was released from prison, he began a campaign to combat distracted driving, especially texting while driving. Some states now have legal penalties for it in certain circumstances. Here in Ohio, for example, all, as it's quoted, it's spelled out, electronic wireless communications device usage, even hands-free, is illegal for any driver under the age of 18 in Ohio. and probably not a great idea for anybody else, I would add, especially the non-hands-free. The other may afford some protection. Can you think of any spiritual analogies? Think of those two phrases, the ones that we use when we talk to other drivers. Keep your eyes on the road. You know, there's a phrase in 2 Chronicles chapter 20 when Hezekiah is pleading with God to intervene and save them. And he talks about, our eyes are upon you. And of course, that's where our eyes need to be too. Keep your eyes on the road. Keep your eyes on the path to God's family and his kingdom. And don't be distracted by what is flowing all around us all the time, the traffic of this world. Then there's the other phrase, check your blind spot. After all, it's one thing to be keeping your eyes somewhere specifically, but how do you focus on a blind spot if you can't see it? How do we deal with that? Again, case in point, the sermonette from Mr. Slagle today. Clearly a blind spot for Abraham and Sarah, as their names were later changed to, and yes, even Hagar. But the customs of the time were so ingrained in their lives and what they saw around them that it was a temptation to short-circuit what God had promised. It's not so easy to remember things that are out of sight and out of mind, and we just can't see them. I looked up a definition online, a physiological blind spot. You know, we all do have a tiny little spot in our vision that we cannot pick up. Here's the definition. The blind spot, visually, is the location on the retina, known as the optic disc, where the optic nerve fiber exits the back of the eye. Because there are no cones or rods at this point on the retina, there is a very small gap in the visual field. Researchers have proposed a number of different explanations as to why we do not notice this blind spot. Some suggest that the opposite eye compensates for the missing visual information. And of course, we have the two eyes to give us a way of sorting out depth perception. If you only have vision in one eye, it's very hard to have depth perception. One of the most commonly accepted theories is that the brain actually fills in the missing information using visual cues in the environment. I found that most fascinating of all. That your brain itself actually draws in what it expects will be in that tiny blind spot by the visual cues around it. Think about that last part as we go a little bit further into our topic today. After all, that's physical. What about spiritual blind spots? Could we have those? Are there spiritual spots on our spiritual retina where we don't have any cones or rods, to put it that way, where it's very hard to pick up what is we're missing, and it becomes a blind spot? I'm sure we all know and think that sometimes everybody around us, like other drivers, may have those blind spots, but there again, what about us? What about you? What about me? It's interesting to try to do a little research online. You can find some discussions by various columnists or psychologists or bloggers or life coaches in various areas like this, dealing with what they describe as emotional blind spots. There's enough literature out there you can actually do some reading on it. I've checked out or read a few and found them of interest. There are some who find correlation, their points find correlation, I would think, with spiritual blind spots, because that's really what we want to focus on. If we can see them, and that's the trick, because remember, they're called blind spots for a reason. One blogger I found had some interesting points. She pointed out three tip-offs. She was trying to help. She was a life coach, and she pointed out three tip-offs she tried to use to help her clients spot some of these things. She was kind of funny. At one point, she was very amusing. She said one of the ladies who came to her was just convinced that it was always somebody else's fault. And she said, I'm convinced that if they could train seeing-eye dogs to see emotional blind spots, she would develop a dog allergy. Just couldn't see it. She explained the tracks that a blind spot leaves are repetitive experiences that seem to you to be inexplicable. I thought that was interesting. The things that make you exclaim, "Why does this keep happening to me?" And of course, the question ought to be, who's the common denominator in all of this? So she gave a couple of clues that in her counseling she did. She said, she tries to help her clients see. She says, one of the patterns, one of the tracks, you can't see it happening, but there's a track that's left. One of the tracks is you keep having the same relationship over and over again with different people. And another one, she says, you think your luck never changes. Somebody else must just be luckier than I am. My luck never changes. Or she says, people who consistently describe you in a way that doesn't match your image of yourself. Well, that's not how I am, but people keep saying that's how you are. Over and over and over again, they say this. She says, those are tracks. Those are little telltale tracks that are left that could tell you something's wrong. And those points are well worth thinking about. Could they also, something like that, help us see if you or I could potentially, possibly have blind spots of spiritual character? Are there things we're not seeing? And that's what's really important. So scripturally, let's focus on that and see what God's Word says. As I mentioned, Mr. Slagle's sermonette was a perfect introduction for this kind of a sermon, and we didn't discuss the details at all ahead of time. If we did, I forgot about them and put the sermon together after that, so maybe there's a factor there. But first of all, let's go to a scripture that I suspect many of you have read scores of times, hundreds of times in the book of James. It's in James chapter 2. James is trying to describe something about how faith works. And he says in James 2 and verse 17, faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. In other words, it has to have some evidence that it's there. You can't really see it. You can't see faith. It's kind of blind. But someone will say, you have faith and I have works. He says, you show me your faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. You believe that there's one God. You do well. Even the demons believe and tremble. But then he asks a rhetorical question, and it is a form of a question. But do you want to know, O foolish man, that faith without works is dead? Interesting question. We often read it, I think, as a statement. But if it's a question, what's the answer? Well, if we were to try to answer it as a rhetorical question, I think we'd have to say the answer is, if you're talking to a foolish person, the answer is no. They don't want to know that. Do you want to know, O foolish man, that faith without works is dead? The answer is no. And sometimes it's harder to confront blind spots. Sometimes if some of those tip-offs or tracks that one blogger I read about, or life coach, gave as hints, you know, you have the same relationship over and over again, but with different people. Or somehow your luck never changes. Or different people keep describing you in a way that just doesn't match your image of yourself. You think, I'm not like that. I'm not that kind of person. I don't do that. And over and over and over again, you hear people say, oh, yes, you do. Yes, you do. Yes, you do. Those are hard things to find. And James 2 and verse 20, I think, speaks to that. Here's another familiar verse in Jeremiah 17. Jeremiah 17, famous passage. The heart, verse 9, is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Look at the last four words. Who can know it? In other words, the fact that the human heart can deceive itself can be a blind spot. Because Jeremiah asked the question, who can know it? Who can see it? And sometimes the answer is we can see it in others, but it's a lot harder to see it in ourselves. Once again, it's a question. Who can know it? If there's a question in there, what's the answer? Blind spots. Proverbs chapter 14. I know these are familiar verses. I'll blame Mr. Pavlik too. You're hearing them over and over again. Proverbs 14, verse 12. How many times have you read this? There is a way that seems right to a man. It seems right. This person thinks he's considered all the possibilities. This is the right way to go. Did Abraham take that approach? Maybe he did, by the customs of his time. Did Sarah take that approach? Maybe she did, by the customs of her time. But what's the way this works out? But its end is the way of death. Look at the results of that one decision. Mr. Slagle alluded to it. Look at the results that have played out over thousands of years of that one decision. Proverbs 16:25, of course, repeats verbatim from Proverbs 14:12. There is a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. When God repeats something, it must mean something. If he has us read it again, there must be something in it we should take note of. These are statements. There are no questions here. It just states it flat out. But is there something that is hidden? Yes, there is. There is a way that seems right to a man. Something is missing. There is a blind spot. There isn't a question to show it up this time, but there's something missing. There is a blind spot in these verses. Sometimes questions hide things. Maybe we don't need one here to find something that's hidden. Certainly there is a plethora of moral and biblical blind spots in our world. What about us? We live in this world just like Abraham and Sarah lived in their world, their culture, their time. We look at that and say, what a ridiculous idea. But if it's being done all around you, maybe it doesn't seem quite so ridiculous. There are a lot of things that happen in our world that perhaps Abraham and Sarah are going to come up in the resurrection and say, that's ridiculous. How could people think this? Well, they do in our day, in our time, in our culture, in our world. Another place, Romans 8:7. These are all familiar verses. A little bit of background. Verse 5 of Romans 8, those who live according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh, but those who live according to the Spirit on the things of the Spirit. For to be carnally minded or fleshly is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. Again, factor that in to some of the examples. The prime example we've referred to so far is I've borrowed from Mr. Slagle's sermonette. And then he says, here's the reason, verse 7, there's a reason for that. Because the carnal mind is enmity against God. In other words, the fleshly mind, especially apart from God, has what we would call in our time, in our day with computer background, a default drive. There's a default drive. And we tend to default to what the patterns are that we see around us and the patterns that we know from our experiences. When we come into the knowledge of God's truth, we have a whole lot of overriding of programs to do, don't we? Overriding and overwriting of programs. And then he says, for it is not subject to the law of God, nor indeed can be. Then you have to go back to the previous verse to find out how to get around that. To be carnally minded is death. To be spiritually minded is life and peace. He explains, those who are in the flesh can't please God, but here's the good news. Verse 9, you are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, if the Spirit of God dwells in you. That's the answer. Now, if anyone doesn't have the Spirit of Christ, same Spirit as we know, he is not his. And if Christ is in you, the body is dead because of sin, but the Spirit is life because of righteousness. Yes, we're going to die. And physically, that's the way we're structured, as we know. But there is the potential for real life Not life that is measured in the passage of years and decades, but life that goes on permanently in a way that none of us can fully understand. But I'm just curious enough that I want to find out all about it, don't you? What do these words say to us? What's the impact? What are we learning from it? Could you come up with some questions to ask God here? I think we probably all could. Let's go to one more for the moment, and that's back in Isaiah chapter 55. And once again, you may be recognizing all of these references when I give the chapter and verse. You might say, I think I know what that is. Isaiah 55. To get some background or context, we'll start in verse 6. Seek the Lord, or seek the Eternal, while He may be found. Call upon Him while He is near. Now, that applies especially to those who have been given the blessing of John 6:44. God is near if He has opened your mind. He is, in that sense, available and surrounding the world, but they can't really tap into that yet. Not unless God causes that miracle, according to Jesus Christ in John 6:44. And then verse 7, let the wicked forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Eternal, or the Lord. He will have mercy on him and to our God, for He will abundantly pardon. And then these famous verses 8 and 9, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Again, go back to the example of Abraham and Sarah. How does this apply there? What was the solution that first Sarah and then Abraham gave, in a sense, lip service to, or even accepted her suggestion? It was to use the culture of the time to have the maid Hagar be like a substitute wife or a concubine, and in that sense raise up seed to Sarah, as you heard explained in the sermonette. Seems odd to us. It was like a surrogate. But that wasn't God's answer. His answer was on a much higher plane. His answer was, I'm going to perform a miracle, and Sarah will be able to conceive and bear a child. What was the reaction Abraham and Sarah had to it, both of them? They both laughed. They both laughed. You must be kidding. He's 100. You know, sometimes I'm driving down the road and somebody's going too slow, and I'm sitting there thinking, I'm 100. I'm going to be 100 before I can get where I'm going. Well, Abraham was 100 when he was getting where God was taking him, and Sarah was 90. That's not in the realm of possibility, but it was for God. It was for God. You know, it makes me think of another verse in Jeremiah about, is there anything too hard for me? But we don't immediately see that. Some things we are blinded to. What's the theme of all of these verses? Where does it all lead? Is there something here that you and I need to be really carefully considering and eliminating the distractions of our routine lives in order to do it? As an aside, I found it interesting, the comments in this week's In Accord. If you haven't seen it yet, Mr. Doug Horchak hosted it. Some of the comments from volunteers on the recent FOI English language projects in Malawi and Zambia. Very interesting, because they brought up the concept, a common theme was that the simplicity of the lives of those brethren they were helping to learn English, and how different their lives are from ours. Mr. Meeker's blogs have the same reaction sometimes. You know, some of the places he travels to, into the heart of French-speaking Africa, parts of French-speaking Africa. And sometimes they end up in places where the face of a white man is rare. And little children, they don't have any qualms about just reacting the way this is surprising. Some of them are frightened by it, but others find it just incredibly interesting and amazing, and they just want to gather around and see this person. simplicity has a lot to commend it. Now, I don't think we'd want to live in a tent or have to hunt for our food all the time or live in some of those very deprived circumstances. Some of the areas where they talked about the inflation rate, 500% in a year. Can you imagine paying, you know, if it's 100% increase, that's doubled. So if it's a 500% increase, it's six times what you were paying a year ago. Sometimes it may feel like that when you fill up your car at the pump, although it's gotten a little better lately, which is much appreciated. I don't know about you, but the last time I checked my credit card bill for gas purchases, I've kind of blinked a couple of times and said, what happened with that? You know, I mentioned earlier, talking about literal driving, that the blind spot can be caused by distractions like texting, like talking, like losing the focus on the road. Could the same thing be true spiritually? And our Western society, as those FOI volunteers noted, has plenty of distractions. Plenty of distractions. What about today? On God's Sabbath, that's a good thing to entertain, to think about, to meditate about. How are you and I going to spend the rest of this Sabbath, for example? Summertime, when we leave here, there's still quite a bit of time left on the Sabbath. In the wintertime, not so. In the wintertime, we talk until the sun goes down sometimes. But it's not the same. Will we still use the time profitably as God's holy time, drawing close to Him, His Son, each other, fellowship time perhaps? As far as what we know or don't know about ourselves, I've blended together several sources to come up with some possible things to consider lists, some from bloggers, some from other sermons I've heard other pastors give over the years, some from other reading and studying too. But let me give you a couple of instances of things to be aware of. Number one, there are plenty of things we do know about ourselves, right? And not everything is a blind spot, thankfully. There are things that we see pretty accurately about ourselves. And other people do too. You know, some people say, well, my life's an open book. Well, I doubt if that's true for anybody completely, but there are some people who are certainly more open than others and more reserved in some other categories and things. So there are some things we know about ourselves and others do too. That's kind of a comfortable area. It's not a blind spot. Okay. Now it begins to get a little more complicated. There are things that you and I don't seem to know about ourselves, but other people are well aware of it. You ever have things like that in your life? Where you something that apparently you don't see yourself that way, but others do. Like that one blogger said, if people keep telling you what their impression is of you and it doesn't match your own self-image, that may be one of those little tracks, an indicator that there's a blind spot here. Because everybody else or several other people whose opinions I normally respect see this way. That's something to check into, possible blind spot. Maybe I am like that. Maybe I do give that impression. Then there's the reverse. There are things we know deep down about ourselves, but other people don't. That's a danger area. That's a danger area. One minister I heard speak about this kind of thing several years ago said, he just used the phrase, deceit lives here. Thought it was interesting. Deceit lives here. There are some things we really wouldn't want other people to know about. And there are some things probably it's better off. You know, we wouldn't want any of us to have our worst character traits, you know, emblazoned on a screen somewhere, put all over the internet. But it's true that in this area, sin can find a home here as we try to hide what we know we really are. And then there's a really tricky category, and it appears in the story of Abraham and Sarah, this one was what was happening. There are things we don't know about ourselves, and nobody else does either, but God does. God does. God knew what He wanted to do with Abraham and Sarah. He knew what His plan was. And it was very hard for them to carry on and be patient all those years to see it play out that way. So yes, there are blind spots here. And they're effective blind spots that we don't know about it, and even other people don't, but God does. God does. He can show these things to us. But here's the kicker. Do we want Him to? Do we want Him to? Could you or I have spots like that? Blind spots like that? Some of the things I've talked about aren't blind spots. Those are fine. You know it. People know it. That's fine. We're fine. It's open. And then there are things they seem to see and we don't. Then there are things we know and we don't want people to know about. And then there's stuff that only God knows. That's the tricky part. I think people have that nagging suspicion sometimes. There are things we simply avoid pursuing because they're painful. It's hard. We may not even know they're there. Maybe only God does. Sometimes we think, well, I've already got my hands full with the things I do know about. I really don't want to go, you know, prodding and pushing and digging and finding more to work on. And there's some validity to all those comments, but in the end, they leave us short of the mark. They leave untouched some things we really need to know. And just like a blind spot in driving can cause an accident, a spiritual blind spot can cause spiritual accidents. Paul used a similar phrase in his day. He used the term shipwreck. Remember, he talked about individuals who had made shipwreck of their lives. That was about as close as he could get in describing it. We would say, well, that's an accident waiting to happen. Let me show you what I mean by a couple of biblical examples that are well known to us, but we can take some time. The first one is probably the earliest book written or the earliest time described in the Bible, and it's the book of Job. The book of Job. This may be the most famous person in the Bible whose life so clearly illustrates this point. So let's take a little closer look. There are a lot of ways to study the book of Job. Let's take a gander this way. Job 1 and verse 1, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and shunned evil." This was the public man Job. The one he, like anyone, would have wanted others to see. And certainly he was a commendable man. He even could list, if someone asked him, his public face. If you read chapter 29, you'll find as he was beginning to despair of his situation in the trial that we know is coming, he even begins by saying in verse 2 of Job 29, "Oh, that I were as in months past, as in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone about my head or on my head, when by his light I walked through darkness. I was in the days of my prime." We even use that phrase now. He's in his prime. "When the friendly counsel of God was over my tent, when he was yet with me, when my children were around me." That was so sad. "When my steps were bathed with cream." Well, that's an interesting description. "And the rock poured out rivers of oil for me." And then he goes on to list some of the things that he did, some of his, I guess you'd say, good deeds, but he just lists this is what he made a practice of doing. This was why he was perceived this way. Pretty impressive. But there's so much more to the story, as we well know, much more. Let's go back to the early part of the story for a little bit of setup. In verse 6, we know the story. "There was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, 'From where do you come?' So Satan answered the Lord and said, 'From going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it.'" A little bit lippy. "Then the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job? That there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and an upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil.'" Now, that was, of course, going to really annoy Satan, you can imagine. "So he answered the Lord and says, 'Does Job fear God for nothing?' He says, 'Haven't you made a hedge around him, around his household, around all that he has on every side. You've blessed the work of his hands. His possessions have increased in the land. He said, stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. Then we'll see if he fears God and shuns evil. I've added that. The Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power, but, he put a limit, only do not lay a hand on his person. And we know the tragedy that followed. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. You find the horrors that befall him, it seems, within a matter of hours. He loses all of his children in a storm. He loses his wealth of his herds and his animals by a band of raiders. I've got those reversed order, but look at what Job's response is. Job arose, verse 20, tore his robe, shaved his head, all signs of extreme distress, and he fell to the ground and he worshiped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. Not to his mother's womb, but it's a poetic thing. I came into this world, and I'm going to leave this world naked. I have nothing, had nothing when I came in, and I'm going to have nothing when I leave. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. That's astonishing. And all this, verse 22 says, Job did not sin, nor did he charge God with wrong. Before we're too hard on Job, try walking a mile in those sandals. Now, that's the basic setup for what would happen. It goes on, and it gets worse. We find in chapter 2 that, once again, God allows Satan to come into his presence and basically says the same thing. Where have you come from? He says, I've been walking to and fro, walking back and forth. And God asks the same question. Have you considered my servant Job? And then he goes on to add, and still he holds fast to his integrity, even though you incited me against him to destroy him without cause. Well, actually, Satan did that. God just allowed it. Satan said, well, yeah, you put a hobble on me, skin for skin. All that a man has, he'll give for his life. But you stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and I know this will happen. He'll curse you to your face. God said, all right, he's in your hand, but don't kill him. Spare his life. So Satan went out from the presence of the Eternal and struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. I can't even imagine what that would be like. He sat on a heap of ashes and scraped himself with a pottery shard. And then his wife couldn't bear it anymore, and she said, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Basically, she said, curse God and die. That's the only way out of your misery. And he said, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Should we accept good from God and not adversity? And all this, Job did not sin with his lips. This is astonishing. And now his three friends show up, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. And Zophar, they haven't said anything of any value. In fact, for a week, they said nothing. Verse 13, they sat with him on the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and no one spoke a word because they saw his grief was very great. And we have a term in English, an idiom, we call it a Job's comforter. You don't hear it often anymore, but it's a phrase, an idiom that some may have heard. We know too well what it means because we're familiar with the biblical record. Perhaps that's why it's not in common use anymore, because people aren't familiar with the Bible anymore. It goes deeper. What's going through his mind? His friends begin to talk to him finally, and he responds and actually gives a retort, and a little bit of a debate ensues. In chapter 9, He says in verse 14, how can I answer him, God, and choose my words with him or to reason with him? Though I were righteous, I couldn't answer him. I would beg mercy of my judge. If I called and he answered me, I wouldn't believe that he was listening to my voice. It's getting tough. He crushes me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. He won't allow me to catch my breath, but fills me with bitterness. If it's a matter of strength, indeed, he's strong. And if it's justice, who would appoint my day in court? Though I were righteous, my own mouth would condemn me. But if I were blameless, if I opened my mouth, it would prove me perverse. And look at what he says in verse 21. I am blameless, yet I don't know myself. Could that be translated to say there must be a blind spot? There must be a blind spot. I must not be seeing something. And then he says, I despise my life. This kind of life is not worth living. Because he said, it strikes me that it's all one thing. I say he destroys the blameless and the wicked. He says, verse 24, the earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covers the face of its judges. If not he, who else could it be? This is getting to be pretty serious. In verses 27 and 28, he says, if I say I will forget my complaint, I'll put off my sad face and wear a smile, then I'm afraid of my sufferings. They don't make any sense then. I know that you will not hold me innocent. He's searching, searching, searching. That hard drive is spinning. And he can't come up with any answers. Blind spots, they can be painful. He basically says, I know that if I just tried to cover up stuff, that wouldn't really solve anything or get to the heart of the matter. Not that we all want to come to services with long faces. Obviously, we want to come before God and be, you know, rejoicing and happy with each other and join the fellowship and be uplifting. Have you ever felt afraid of all your sufferings? The way he put it in his trials, trials are no fun. Even Jesus Christ asked God to let the cup pass if possible, although he acknowledged that it wasn't. And he stressed his desire for God's will to be done no matter what. It's painful sometimes to come to see that we need to change. So Job was wrestling and struggling. We look at the story of Job and see how it all turns out. We know, of course, from the benefit of having heard the end of the story, how it all turns out, what it came to be. We know that Job did come to see that there was something he couldn't see, and God showed him through all of this. And even in talking to him directly, he was, in a way, putting his own righteousness in on a par with God's. He exalted himself, even claiming to be willing to plead his case with God himself in chapter 10. But in the end, he came to see how wrong that was. His aha moment was in the first six verses of the last chapter, in chapter 42. But there is a spot deep in the struggle in chapter 13 where I think it identifies for us that he knows he's got a blind spot. And he is asking at some point, asking God to help him see it. It's in chapter 13. In verse 20, he did say in verses, even going back to verse 13, hold your peace with me and let me speak, then let come on me what may. Why do I take my flesh in my teeth, put my life in my hands? Though he slay me, I will trust him. Even so, I will defend my own ways before him. He'll be my salvation, for a hypocrite could not come before him. Listen carefully to my speech and to my declaration with your ears. See, I've prepared my case. I know that I shall be vindicated. He knew that there were things to do and some things to be and a character to have that was right. Who is he who will contend with me? If I hold my tongue, I perish. Only two things now, verse 20, do not do to me. Then I will not hide myself from you. Withdraw your hand far from me, and let not the dread of you make me afraid. Then call, and I'll answer, or let me speak, and you respond. How many are my iniquities and sins? That's a direct question. What am I missing? The last part of the verse, make me know my transgression and my sin. Help me see my blind spot. He laid out what he understood and then basically says, I must be missing something. I must be missing something. He was coming as clean as he knew how to and trying to be brutally honest with God. And that required being that way with himself first, and that was hard. And that's a problem for all of us humans. Maybe especially hard to be honest with ourselves. But he does want some assurances before he edges closer to God. And they're in verse 21, and they're kind of interesting. The first one may be a little hard to figure out. It says, withdraw your hand far from me. The word for far is a basic meaning in Hebrew. It's a basic word. It's rahak, and it means to be distant or to abandon. It can express the idea of an exile or abstaining from something bad or somebody being distant in a relationship. For example, it's used in chapter 30 and verse 10 to express his feelings that his friends were, as it says, keeping their distance or being aloof from him. Same Hebrew word, rahak. The most obvious feeling is that he's afraid of God's heavy hand and he wants God himself to protect him from that treatment. Show me, but please be gentle. Please be gentle. Let not the dread of you make me afraid, was the second request. He wants to ask God something, but he's a little hesitant. There's a way in which he wants to venture closer to God to ask that question, but he's pretty sure there's something he doesn't know. He's pretty sure he has blind spot, but he's a little afraid of what'll happen when God shows it to him. You ever felt that way? One translation, well, it's really just a paraphrase. The Living Bible puts it this way, and it's not often accurate for details, but it captures the flow sometimes. Here's the Living Bible from verses 20 to 23. Oh God, there are two things I beg you not to do to me. Only then will I be able to face you. Don't abandon me, and don't terrify me with your awesome presence. That's interesting. Don't abandon me. Don't be that far from me. Don't leave me and go away. But don't terrify me with your awesome presence. Call to me to come. How quickly I will answer. Or let me speak to you and you reply. Tell me, what have I done wrong? Help me. Point out my sin to me. Living Bible. Those two phrases, don't abandon me and don't terrify me with your awesome presence. Those are hard things to say, brethren, for any of us. What about you and me? Do we see sometimes that, boy, there's a pattern here I don't like. Something's not quite right. Maybe it's one of those tracks earlier. Keep having the same relationship but with different people. Or people say that, you're like this, and you say, I'm not like that at all, but then somebody else says it, and somebody else says it, and somebody else says it. That can be distressing. Job had some difficult things to learn, but he did learn them. He was a better man, if I can put it that way, because he did. More useful in God's service, no doubt a better husband, a better father to those 10 new children that he and his wife had, a better man to all around him. Even better than chapter 29, when he listed the things he wanted to do to help. Could we change too? Sometimes we might think it's too late, I'm too old, patterns are set in stone, nothing will ever really be different in my life, but the simple answer was Job did change. You read of God's blessings in the rest of his life, his family in chapter 42, it's a pretty amazing story. He was ready to ask God to show him his blind spot. It's not easy. The Apostle Paul is another biblical example I'd like to use. Over the years, in personal study and in putting sermons together, I've come across and dug a little deeper into Paul's life. I've read a few other Coney Barron Housen's The you know, the epistles of Paul and the writings of Paul. That's interesting. It's an old, old work, but it has some value. Various translations. The Phillips translation is quite good with his letters. I think we get to a point, brethren, where we actually feel like we know these people. And we want to meet them in the family of God. I have a whole list of questions for Paul. I have a whole list of questions for a lot of people. It's going to take, I don't know, hundreds of years to get them all answered. Oh, wait, we'll have hundreds of years. Paul has become clearer the more I read and think and study. I've come to see him as a man who had some very difficult things from his past to deal with, things that he never really fully got over. Changes he needed to make, just like Job did, just like we all do. He had some major blind spots before God literally struck him blind so that he could see. Pretty amazing. You know, when you read some of his letters, like 1 Corinthians 15, read these letters as if it's a friend of yours who's pouring out his heart to you. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 3, he says, "For I delivered to you, first of all, that which I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he rose again the third day according to the Scriptures, and he was seen by Cephas, and then by the 12." That was Peter, of course. "After that, he was seen by over 500 brethren at once, of whom the greater part remain to the present, but some have fallen asleep. After that, he was seen by James, and then by all the apostles." And then pick up these last words. "Then last of all, he was seen by me, as by one born out of due time. For I am the least of the apostles." Would you describe Paul that way? I certainly wouldn't. "Who am not worthy to be called an apostle." Why? "Because of my past," he says. "Because I persecuted the church of God." I wonder how many nightmares he had about that and for how many years. I wonder if it ever totally went away. I think there'll be some tearful and joyful reunions in the first resurrection with some surprise on one side, but joy in the end. Remarkable man. 20 years later, this book was written about 20 years after his conversion, mid-50s. We think his conversion was mid-30s AD. 20 years later, and he still characterized himself as not worthy to be an apostle, the least of all the apostles, one born out of due time. Had Paul changed? Incredibly, his name was even changed. It was Saul, now it was Paul. Remember, in Acts 9, when he was first struck down on the road to Damascus, that Ananias, the one who was told to go to him and see him, Ananias didn't want to go, understandably. He was told to lay hands on him so that he could be healed and then go ahead and baptize him. How did all that happen? Wouldn't you like to have been a fly on the wall proverbially there to see that? We don't have quite the detailed personal account that we have in the book of Job, but there is something right there in Acts chapter 9 and the account of his calling that I think qualifies for this sermon today. So let's look at Acts 9. Verse 1, "And Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest." You realize that just the previous two chapters was the death of Stephen, the first martyr of the New Testament church, and Saul, as he was then, held the coats of those who were stoning him to death. And we know the story of how he was delivering brethren to the authorities, breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest, asked letters from him to the synagogues in Damascus, so that if he found any who were of the way, whether men or women, he could bring them bound to Jerusalem. As he journeyed, he came near Damascus, and suddenly a light shone around him from heaven, and he fell to the ground, and he heard a voice saying, "Saul, Saul, Why are you persecuting me? We find from verse 7 that those who were journeying with him heard a voice, but they didn't see anyone. They didn't register in the same way. Why are you persecuting me? That had to have been a shock. He didn't view what he was doing as persecution, did he? He viewed it as doing God's work. Isn't there a prophecy about those who kill you or think they do God a service? Matthew 24, Luke 21, Mark 13. That was Paul or Saul. And he said, "Who are you, Lord?" Just a title of respect. Then the Lord said, "I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. It is hard for you to kick against the goads." A sharpened instrument at the attached to the chariot behind where the horses pulled, so that if they slackened off or pulled back, they would be stuck with these goads, and it encouraged them to keep going. He said, "Saul, you're like you're hooked up in the traces like a horse, and you keep backing off. You keep shrinking back from what you're supposed to do." And he's trembling and astonished. I guess so. Put yourself in his shoes. Here I am doing the work of God, and I'm struck down, and I'm asked, "Why are you persecuting me?" And then his answer, "What do you want me to do?" Then the Lord said to him, "Arise and go into the city, and you will be told what you must do." Quite a story. The men who journeyed with him stood speechless, hearing a voice but seeing no one. He acted on what he'd been told. The full answer came later to Paul. It came a little sooner to Ananias, as we read on. Kind of interesting. Saul arose from the ground. When his eyes were opened, he saw no one. But they led him by the hand, brought him to Damascus. He was 3 days without sight and didn't eat or drink. And there was a disciple there named Ananias, and God spoke to him in a vision, "Ananias, here I am, Lord. Arise and go to the street called Straight. Inquire at the house of Judas for one called Saul of Tarsus. He's praying, and in a vision he has seen a man named Ananias coming in and putting his hand on him so that he might receive his sight." Ananias answered, "Lord, I've heard from many about this man, how much harm he has done to your saints in Jerusalem. Here he has authority from the chief priest to bind those who call on your name." Look at the answer God gives him. "Go, for he is a chosen vessel of mine to bear my name before Gentiles, kings, and the children of Israel. I will show him how many things he must suffer for my name's sake." And Ananias went his way, just, "Yes, sir. Yes, Lord." Courage. Blind spots. Did Ananias have a blind spot? Sure he did. His blind spot was, "This guy is bad news, and you're telling me, go and talk to him, lay my hands on him? I don't want him to be healed." Might have been his human reaction. But he accepted because he knew the source. He came in, he laid his hands on him, and look at how he greets him. "Brother Saul, the Lord Jesus, who appeared to you on the road as you came, has sent me that you may receive your sight and be filled with the Holy Spirit." Immediately there fell from his eyes something like scales, and he received his sight at once. He arose and was baptized. Pretty astonishing. Pretty astonishing. Paul would be a lifetime learning the full answer to those questions. Sometimes he didn't always have the answers. Remember that 3 times he prayed to God for healing from whatever the ailment was, we're not told. Perhaps it was poor eyesight. One letter he says, "You see with what large hand I've written my greeting myself," and most of them were written by someone else, Silas or Silvanus, Timothy, others who wrote for him. Maybe that's what it was. Given his background, there would be a lifetime of suffering for Christ's sake, just as Ananias was told. Did he learn? Did he change? You bet he did. Read his statement at the end of 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 7 and 8. There is one more example, actually, that I would like to use today, but it's not recorded in the Bible. Not yet. And that is you and me. All of us. As we drive down the road of life, do we have spiritual blind spots? How many times have you read 2 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 5? Oh, I know when we tend to read it, before the spring holy days. But it has a message for us at any time of the year. And in fact, there's a little phrase buried in there that fits the sermon today about blind spots. 2 Corinthians 13, verse 5 says, "Examine yourselves as to whether you are in the faith. Test yourselves." Look at the next phrase. "Do you not know yourselves?" Couldn't that be worded, "Do you have any blind spots? Do you not know yourselves that Jesus Christ is in you? Unless indeed you are disqualified. But I trust that you will know that we are not disqualified." You know, wouldn't we come to God and ask the same two things that the patriarch Job did so many years ago? Wouldn't we say, "Don't abandon me. Don't go so far off I can't reach you anymore. Don't abandon me. And don't terrify me with your awesome presence." I think we'd probably echo the words of Jeremiah. When we come to God, maybe you've prayed these words. Jeremiah 10 and verse 23, Jeremiah writes, "O Lord, I know the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man who walks to direct his own steps." Translated, we all have blind spots. "O Lord, correct me. Restore my vision," we might say. "Help me see my blind spots, but with justice, not in your anger, lest you bring me to nothing." I think verse 25 may be a kind of a knee-jerk reaction a bit. "Pour out your fury on the Gentiles who don't know you. And on the families who don't call on your name, they've eaten up Jacob, devoured and consumed him, and made his dwelling place desolate." Please be patient, be gentle, be loving, be kind. Show me, but please be easy. How does God answer that prayer? Many ways. Some maybe unexpectedly. He may answer it through your own personal study of his word. You ever just be reading, studying someday, and something just hits you in a way you never thought of before? Sure you have. A thought may come to you when you're praying, which you then follow up with meditation and study. You may hear something in a sermon or a sermonette which sparks a thought. Maybe you're having a conversation with somebody, especially with somebody else in the church who walks the way you do, who has God's Spirit too, and you think about it. Or a statement somebody makes that's not even really directed at you. There are all kinds of possibilities. Sometimes trials can have that effect on us. Look at Job. They may really make us search our hearts and minds to see what there is we really could learn from all this. What are my blind spots? Sometimes friends may just flat out tell us something. "Do you know you're like this?" That may be hard to take. Maybe we have something of an aha experience ourselves as a result of all of it put together. Prayer, meditation, study of God's word, fasting. That's the old toolbox, you know. In a way, then, it feels like God spoke to us, and in a way, he did. How do we react when we find those things out? Hopefully the way Job did, the way Paul did. But you know what? That part's up to us. It really is, and it's not easy. Does it drive us to our knees to ask God's help? Do we stay close to him? To ask him, "Maybe there's something I don't see. Please help me see. Please be gentle. But please help me see." And when we do we, with God's help, change? Do we come to a point where those spots are not blind anymore? That's the goal, brethren. And we know from just a few scriptural references today and many more we didn't look at, it's possible, and it's what God wants. We all know that the traffic of our lives has its challenges, literally and metaphorically. Maybe it sometimes makes us think of analogies to our own spiritual lives. Remember that one part of the definition about the literal physical blind spot? I found that one interesting. Part of the definition online was one of the most commonly accepted theories is that the brain actually fills in the missing information using visual cues in the environment. Ask yourself a question. What is the source of most of the cues in my environment? Are most of the cues in my environment spiritual? Or are they mostly physical, fleshly, of the world and of the around? Of this world and its society and its values? Or from God's word? Where do my cues come from? Because wherever they come from, they will fill in our blind spots. That's a deep question to ponder as we finish the sermon today.